For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy to have Roy Wyman giving the talk tonight. Roy's, maybe some of you don't know Roy if you've been coming only on Monday evenings, because Roy usually comes on Sundays, so welcome to Monday evenings. Roy is on our board of directors and was lay ordained by Shohaku Okamura, my translation collaborator and old friend. Thank you very much, Roy.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. The title of my talk, as you may have seen, is The Accidental Buddhist, or How Mistakes Really Threw Me Into Practice and Have Furthered My Practice. And in talking with Tygon about what to talk about, I gave him a few ideas, and one of the ideas was to give sort of the generic how I came to practice talk, but to tell you the truth, I'm not that interesting. I really thought there should be some other things in there as well, and really if there's one cohesive thread throughout my life, it's my ability to make lots of mistakes. And so given that, I thought, why not go through my life and point out a few of the mistakes and the lessons that I've drawn from those, and it may be that the lessons I've drawn from them are mistakes as well. So feel free to draw your own lessons. And as I like to say, some people live as an example to others, some live as a warning, so you can choose which I am. And I think one of my basic mistakes is that I've been caught up in an idea, and I formed this idea, or it was given to me early on in life, that there was some sort of perfect life out there, some way of living that I was supposed to live. And that to the extent that my life matched up that ideal life, then I was doing it right. And that if I didn't live that ideal life, then I was doing it wrong. And there's supposed to be this perfect life to be had. And my job was to just simply match that. And so I've created this idea of a mistake. And that idea of a mistake, of not matching up my life with that perfect life, I think is the only mistake that I've really made in some ways, is that putting that label on it. And so think through that a little bit as I'm talking, and about how much of these are really mistakes and how much of the mistakes are because I haven't matched some ideal out there, and how much of it, of our mistakes, are the creation of our own mind, and that the creation of the ideal of a perfect life is to bring with it the ideal of a mistake. And kind of getting to that, and sometimes the perspective one has, you could say that my first mistake was being born in the wrong place if I ever wanted to be a Buddhist. If you talk to my mom, she'd tell you that the only thing I did right was being born where I was, and that everything since then has been a mistake. But I was born in a fundamentalist home, or at least maybe not born into it, but quickly became a fundamentalist Christian home. When I was about 8, my parents became born again and found Jesus. And they found Jesus in a very particular sort of mode, that of a fundamentalist charismatic church. If you aren't familiar with charismatics, they're the ones that raise their hands, speak in tongues, dance in the spirit, slain in the spirit, do lots of things in the spirit, other than drinking in the spirits. So that was how I was raised from about the age of 8 on. And my dad actually became a minister in that church. And I think it's a little bit worthwhile to kind of go through how I was raised and the belief system I had, because I think it ties in with this theme. And also because it's useful to kind of see how others think, and it brings our own beliefs into relief so that we can revisit them, see the good in the other side, see the good and bad in our own. So one of the assumptions that I had growing up is that language was based in reality itself, particularly the Bible. So when one said certain words, they were like magic. If you said, you know, I believe in Jesus, that was magic. Those were actually grounded in reality itself. And it had implications in reality, or so I was taught. Second assumption was that there was an absolute plan for your life. I remember in college, I went to an evangelical college, and somebody asked a friend of mine, can you save my seat? And he turned to the seat and said, did you know that Jesus loves you and has a perfect plan? there was a absolute plan for your life, or for your chair's life, or whomever, but that, like I was talking about, there was this ideal realm out there. And not to get technical, but it's actually something based in Neoplatonic philosophy. So this isn't actually something that existed when the Bible was being written. This came later. But it's this sort of Platonic ideal that there's this ideal realm out there, and that we're sort of shadows of that realm. So if you talk about anything, if you talk about gold, we have an ideal of gold, but you'll never get truly pure gold. But in the ideal realm, there is some block of actual gold that is perfect gold. It is the essence of gold. So in this essential realm, essences exist. And we believed just in that. And many religions do. This is not unique to that brand of Christianity by any means. But I believe that there was a heavenly realm. And that in that heavenly realm, there was a table written somewhere, and my book of what I was supposed to live my life as was written right there. And my job was to match that up. A third belief that we had was that religious fervor, and this wasn't so much said as just assumed, came in a countercultural context. So, you know, we were Jesus freaks. And we owned that, and we loved it. Yeah, I'm a Jesus freak, you know? And so it was, and the time period I was growing up, it was kind of a strange period. It was as the hippies were giving up their beads and taking on double knit polyester suits. So, you know, I was in the whole disco kind of era. And we were counter to everything. When I went to high school, I didn't listen to rock music. I listened to classical music, because rock music was Satan's music. So everything was countercultural, and that was where it came in. And a part of that was actually a rejection of more traditional types of church. So if you went to a typical mainstream church, my idea of that was dead. That was a dead religion, dead faith. And those are the terms we actually used. That was dead. So only in a countercultural sort of setting could you be truly fervent in your faith. And like I said, tradition and ceremony, all the kinds of stuff we do here, that was a sign of, you know, death. So I believe pretty much all of that now. The result of all of those beliefs, though, was that proper belief, and when they used the term faith, it was belief, it was a dogma that one had to buy into, led to a novel understanding and salvation. That was the basic beliefs. Now, it would be easy for me to kind of say, oh, all that was false. And obviously, I've chosen to exit that belief system, and I've chosen to exit that community. But that doesn't mean everything they said was had no value or that we can't learn from it. I think there is an ultimate reality out there, and our language maybe points to it, but I don't really believe in magic words anymore. But that doesn't mean that our words don't matter and that language isn't in some ways pointing to something beyond itself. And I think there is a sense in which, if not an ideal realm, there's value in taking a step back and realizing that we get locked in to this realm very easily. We get locked into our own lives very easily. We get locked into my day-to-day life and the energy, and you might think of it as karmic energy, that carries us forward, that momentum. And we forget that this is just limited. And I don't know that we can ever step into some ideal realm, but I do think we can take a step back and we can see that we are part of a larger interconnected universe. And that in that larger interconnected universe, things are pure, things are true. There is a ground to our being there. And that if we are just looking for fulfillment in the narrow confines of our own ego, it will end up, at least my experience is, that it's been relatively empty. And that I do think there's a sense in which spiritual creativity requires, this is my third, assumption from my past, I think there is a sense in which spiritual creativity does require something of breaking from tradition. That doesn't mean I don't love to bow. It doesn't mean I don't love to chant, that I don't love the incense and all of that. But I do think that if we are doing these things just by rote, without putting anything more into it, any more energy, if we're just, coasting, then we're leaving a lot out there that we haven't experienced. And I think that we have to leave behind some of the religiosity. I had a professor in religion, actually, who said, there's a term for creativity in religion. You know what it's called? The answer is heresy. So we have to be a little bit heretical to be creative with what we do. To the extent that we glorify tradition and ceremony as somehow salvific above our own efforts, if we don't take responsibility for our own saving, then I think, again, we're leaving a lot out. So my first mistake that that really kind of maybe bringing it home is I went to college to become a minister, and my mom again would say that that was not a mistake. I was going to follow in my dad's footsteps. And I took philosophy 101 because I was forced to. And I took it from a professor in an evangelical college, Wheaton College, about 30 miles from here. You may have heard of it. It's sort of in the 70s, it was called the Harvard of Evangelical Colleges. So I went to the ground source of evangelicalism. And I took a course in philosophy, and the professor, very much a Christian, had a great interest in Zen philosophy and koans. And so he would read koans in class and we would talk about them. And I started taking this interest in it, a very philosophical interest. And I think grew a lot intellectually from that, but there was never any real substance to it. It was all an intellectual exercise. And I found out how much of an exercise that was. After I graduated, I went to seminary for a year, dropped out. And in the meantime, I had gotten married, had a child, second child on the way. Started young. Evangelicals tend to do that. I was working, and I was about 25, had applied to law school, and went to a doctor. I had some physical stuff going on. And not to be too graphic, I had to go to a urologist, and I'll tell a quick story just because I love this story. I was in my truck driving there, and any of you who know me well know I love coffee. So I'm driving, and I was running late, which is, again, not a surprise for me, on my way to the urologist, and drinking my coffee in my pickup truck, hit a bump, and the coffee spilled all in my lap. I don't know if any of you have ever been to a urologist. I couldn't turn around and go back. And when you go in the office, everyone is either elderly or in a body cast. There's sort of like no in between. So I was the only one who went in there who could actually walk in without either a walker or, you know, somebody rolling me in. And everybody looked at me, and there was a line, and they saw it, and I had this huge brown stain in my shorts. He said, no, you go ahead. So anyway, all that led to getting surgery, and they said, you know, no big, happens all the time. There's about a 1 in 1,000 chance you have cancer. Well, I had cancer. And, you know, looking back at it, if you had to pick and choose a cancer to get, this was the one. But it wasn't because it was very curable. But this was at a time when you didn't hear a lot of stories of people surviving cancer. And all of a sudden, my very narrow way of looking at the world, where everything was straightforward, where there was a plan for my life, where everything would match up and my life would match that ideal realm, just fell apart. Because there was absolutely nothing good about this. There was no silver lining. It sucked. And there was no way around that. And so my Christian faith started to fall apart. And I don't know if that was the faith as much as my practice of it. But whatever my practice was, it wasn't there. And my Zen understanding wasn't there. There was nothing there. This just made no sense. And I had one of those experiences that you can only have in this sort of situation. All my family came around and they all wanted to see me, and they thought, oh, okay, we'll take Roy out to lunch and brighten his spirits, which is always the worst idea possible, because we went out and everybody was looking at me like it was the last time they were going to see me. And we went to this Chinese restaurant, Chinese buffet, you know, the ones, hot, you know, lights and, you know, food that you don't know how long it's been there. And it was the worst Chinese buffet I've ever had. It would have been a horrible meal, even if it was gourmet, but it was not. It was terrible. So there's like 20 of us sitting around this table. And we finally got to the end of this thing, and everybody's mopey and depressed. And so we get to the fortune cookies, and my daughter's 3, 3 and a half. I look and I say, Micah, open up your fortune cookie. And she opens it up. And it's the typical, you know, you'll have a long life and prosper, or whatever it was, you know, tidings of the future. And we go around the table, you know, 20 of us, everybody opens one up and everybody's got some happy fortune for the future. And I'm the last one. And I open up the fortune cookie and it's empty. And it was hush. I have never seen a room go that quiet that fast. And everyone looked at me like, God has spoken, boy's gonna die. And you know, as I've looked back at that, obviously I didn't. You know, this is, you know, how has that been now? 22 years. So I think I'm out of the woods.
You're probably going to die eventually.
I will die.
Sorry.
You had to ruin it. So as I looked back, I realized, yes, I am going to die. But secondly, my fortune cookie wasn't written yet. And my future wasn't written yet. And I think there's a sense in which, you know, taking that backward step, things are predetermined. You know, the universe is what it is. But there's also a sense in which, within the confines of a set reality, we are free. And we just don't realize it. And we're looking for that fortune. We're looking for some kind of thing in there that's going to tell us, you're going to make it. You're going to be okay. Life's going to work out. And we see that as freeing when really it's imprisoning. But when we can see that it's not written, we are free to make mistakes. And we are free to not make mistakes. And we are free to say, there's no such thing as a mistake. We're free to write our own rules. And then within that structure, we really can, I think, find that freedom. And it's been really liberating for me to look back at that empty fortune cookie and to say, you know, I don't have to do this. You know, no matter how much momentum I have, no matter how many habits I have, I don't have to. That's not to say that karma doesn't affect us, as the fox would tell us. But we do have to honor, you know, karma. We do have to acknowledge it. But we don't have to allow it to steal our freedom. So I guess what I'm saying is that there isn't always a meaning. There isn't always a reason for things. There isn't always a silver lining. There isn't always the purpose that I had thought that there was. But that without that ideal, we can find greater reason here. And I wasn't planning on talking about this, but you know, looking at that and that the painting of the ink of the mountain, you know, I realized we are born in this culture that loves that Platonic ideal realm, and we think that there isn't meaning in this life, there's meaning in that heavenly realm. And when we let go of that need for meaning, when we let go of that need for purpose, all of a sudden, all of the meaning that we put out somewhere else, it can't stay there. It has to go somewhere. It comes right here. So all of that purpose and all of that meaning that we push into another realm, into another life, into heaven or hell or wherever we want to put it, when it can't stay there, it has to be right here. So this moment is all the meaning there is. But if we really experience it, that's all the meaning we could ever want. So, again, by letting go of the ideal realm, we find the freedom in choosing and living our life. One of my mistakes was not taking off my watch at the start of this, so I won't go terribly over and make you guys all mad at me. So, I had gone to college, went to seminary, dropped out. I'm not going to say that was a mistake. Actually worked for the IRS for 3 years, so if you already hated me, you've got more reason. But I did quit that job and went to law school. And I don't know how many attorneys you all have dealt with. Let me right now apologize for all of us. I'd like to think we aren't all quite as bad as the stereotype. And if you want to share any lawyer jokes with me, I've heard a lot of them, and a lot of them are actually pretty funny. But there is a tendency, and that is for lawyers to, if you take a step back in their life, they started out as good kids. They really did. And that's probably their problem, is they started out as really good kids. And they did well. They did well in school. And they, you know, like their teachers liked them. And they liked to kiss up to their teachers. And everybody rewarded them for that. And they thought, you know, if I work really hard, I can get into a good college. And then they got into a good college. You know, if I work really hard, I can get good grades. And I can get into a good law school. And they did. Wow, if I work really hard in law school and I kiss enough butt, I can get to a really good law firm. And they did. And then they get to a really good law firm. I think, if I work hard, I can build up a book of business. I can get lots of clients and make lots of money for my firm. And then I'll make partner. And the gates will open and the angels will sing and my life, I will have attained it. Will have made it. I will have the golden ring. And they make partner. And as somebody who has made partner at a law firm, I can tell you it is not what they advertised. you make partner and it's worse than when you were an associate. And when you're an associate, it was worse than when you were in law school. And when you're in law school, it was worse than when you were in college. So you've attained all of this, you make partner, you think, well, okay, if I work hard enough, I'll get even a bigger book of business and I'll get more money and then I'll be happy. And they aren't. And if you want to know why some lawyers, not all, are really obnoxious and hard to be around, it's because they had success. And it was the worst curse you could ever give these people. And I got a job that fed all of my worst tendencies. All that overachieving, all of that, all fed into it. And I was driven by the rewards of it. I knew that if I just worked hard enough, I could make it. And when I didn't make it, it was miserable. And when I did make it, it was even more miserable. And I found, actually, when I became a lawyer, I moved to North Carolina, found a Zen group, and actually started sitting and doing this. And I know this will shock you, but all of that training and all of that personality, I carried right into the Zendo. So I would be sitting there and I'd thinking, I can sit half lotus, but I'll sit a full lotus for this sitting. Or, you know, I came in with Joe and, you know, Joe's already, you know, done this and, you know, he's being groomed to take over, and why aren't I there? Why is Joe, you know, closer with the teacher than I am? What's going on here? As an aside, I'll note that, you know, as was mentioned, I'm on the board, and believe me, it, you know, getting in with the teacher is not necessarily what you want to do. So there's something to be said for being overlooked and staying below the radar. You don't have to give talks like this. But I did the same thing. And it's really not surprising. And this has actually been studied not only by Buddhists for the last 2,500 years, but by psychologists as well. And there's two types, and they call them learning goals versus performance goals, which I think kind of get me confused. But what they mean by learning goals are not actually learning goals, but the sort of people that are the ones that I described, where they're all about people liking them. They learn a lesson so that everybody will notice it. And their biggest fear is that someone will insult them or won't like them. The performance goals are really what I would call more mastery goals, which is people who learn not because they want to get ahead, but because they just love the subject. And they've actually studied kids and their tendencies in both ways, and there's some interesting things that they have found about them. I know I didn't memorize these, but the people with these sort of learning, what they call learning goals, I'll call competitive goals, actually avoid challenges, believe it or not. So they will avoid things unless they're sure that they can succeed. So anything that really pushes them, they tend not to do. There's also a concept that probably a lot of you have heard of, learned helplessness. This is the one where they do the studies. You get a fish tank and you get a big fish that's hungry and you put a glass thing in between them, and then you have the little guppies here waiting to be eaten. And the big fish will try and get through and it bangs its head against the glass. And eventually it will learn, I can't get to the other side to eat those guppies. And you can take the glass out, and the fish is free to go there, but the fish has learned, I can't do it, and it never will. And they actually did studies with dogs where they gave them light shock in a room, and they couldn't get out of the room. And even though it was like what would appear to be an exit, they couldn't actually get out of it. And 75% of the dogs, even when they turned off so that they could escape, they gave up. And only about 25% would keep trying until they actually could get out. And that sort of learned helplessness is more common with the competitive folks. The other way of saying it is that the mastery folks are more resilient. They keep trying. And the folks who are competitive, surprise, surprise, are less happy. They avoid risk. And they actually perform more poorly, believe it or not. And that's not what we assume. We assume that those folks are the ones who overachieve, but they really don't. Whereas the people who are mastery-oriented aren't. They're happier, they're more curious, and they enjoy their tasks more, and they're actually better at them. Sort of like the... And I think that carries over into our life. And here's another one I wasn't really planning on talking about, but, you know, I heard a story about... well, when you talk about jobs and careers, people have different approaches. Some people approach it as just a negative. I got to go to work. Some people see it as a job. Some people see it as a career, sort of like those lawyers I was talking about. And some people see their jobs as a calling. And I heard a story of a nurse who was on a floor where they had somebody in a coma. And he had been in a coma for literally a year. And one of the family members came in and caught her adjusting a picture on the wall that was across the bed. The family member asked, "Why are you adjusting the picture? He can't see it." And she said, "Well, I know he's going to wake up, and when he does, I want it to be just so." This is somebody who got it, who cared not because it was her job, but because she was caring about the people that she was around. So I think it, you know, I'm probably the only one who's ever brought that sort of competitive spirit into the Zendo, so I'll be the one to admit it. But it creeps up. It really does. And so I have to take that step back and realize, you know, I'm not gonna win it. You know, I can't win the internet. I can't win the Zendo. I can't win it. And I'm not going to. All I can do is just sit here with my mistakes, sit here with my failures, sit here with my practice, and just be there with it. And that's good enough. You know, it's good, it's bad, it is. So, I think a corollary to this is a sense of goals. And yeah, I'm actually going to argue against having goals, which seems a little odd. But I think in the Zendo, I've tended to have goals. And if you think about it, we create goals for things that we think of as being far from ourselves. Like, I don't have a goal of having brown hair or green eyes. I've got those. I don't need to make that a goal. I don't have a goal of growing all my hair. I have a goal of not losing all of it necessarily. But I don't have those. We don't have goals for things that we've already got. I don't have a goal of buying a car that I've already got. So when we create a goal, we create something that we see as far from ourselves. And I think kind of an example of interdependent, co-arising, when we create one side of an equation, we create the other side at the same time. So when we create a goal, we have made the thing we're shooting for far away, if that makes sense. And so even if we were to make a goal of something that was close by that act of making it a goal, we've pushed it away. And I've seen, it's not just me, I have seen people who have made a goal of enlightenment or of wisdom or of depth or whatever it is. And I think when we do that, we take something that is right with us and we push it away. I heard a quote, and I can't find it, and it's frustrating, but I think it was Joshua, but Taigen, tell me if you know this, and I may be making it up. But the quote is, the way is beneath your feet. And I think it was Joshu who said that, or that's what I had heard.
There are lots of phrases like that.
And I think that's...
The way is the next step.
The way is the next step. The way is beneath your feet. In other words, there's no goal to be set. And if we drop the goals and we just sit here where we are, then we don't create that distance from ourselves and the reality that's here. So the next big mistake I made was obviously pursuing this Zen. And the first thing I did is I actually found a group in Charlotte, North Carolina, and started sitting. And I think about the second time I went there, there was this, you know, elderly woman who'd been a nun with a Tibetan group for about 20 years. And she'd been around forever, and she had all this experience, and she did all these, you know, prostrations and all kinds of things that I had no idea about. She knew everything. And we were doing Kinhin, slow walking meditation, and I was in front of her. And I think the mistake I made was I was walking too slowly. But I was walking, and I was very intent, as, you know, I was wont to do back then before I let everything slide. And so I was very intent and, you know, doing it real hard and doing my Kinhin. And all of a sudden, I felt this shove in the back. And it was like, what? And I realized this kindly old nun had just shoved me in the back as I was doing Kinhin. And I was in this, you know, meditative state, and I thought, you know, and I could see the thought arising, wow, I wasn't walking fast enough, or I was doing something wrong. What did I do wrong? And I got all this embarrassment and this feeling of shame. And then the next thing I knew, I thought, well, why was she shoving me? You know, I'm brand new here. What's with that? Why, she isn't what I thought. That's wrong. I would never do that to somebody else. And I felt all this anger come up. And it was the best thing ever. Because I got angry in the perfect state of mind to actually watch it come up. And sure enough, it was that, you know, pain and the embarrassment, and then it ricochets back on itself. And I really do think that she was nuts. And I don't suggest that you shove people in the back during Kinhin. But for me right then, she was a Buddha. And she absolutely taught me one of the best lessons I ever learned. And so the mistake of being in the wrong place at the wrong time actually helped me to watch my brain. And so now when I feel anger come up about something, I'm able to, I've kind of seen how that comes from. So I can take a step back and do that. And kind of the last, and I'll wrap this up, the last mistake I made was, well, I don't know. I mean, this is a few mistakes all wrapped up in one. But I, when I was in North Carolina, I started volunteering with prisons. Started out with a medium security prison and was there for a few years. And then my teacher asked me to start sitting with a group on death row in North Carolina. So I would go usually once or twice a month with them. They met weekly and we would alternate. So it was just me and a handful of guys on death row who had, you know, signed up as being Buddhist and needed instruction. And I would go and sit with them, and then when we had finished sitting, I would give them a short Dharma talk. And so there was one gentleman who was always there, very dedicated. He had a shaved head, about 5'9", bright crystal blue eyes. On his bald head, he had the word hate tattooed, swastikas all up and down his arms. And he'd obviously had some history. And, you know, to kind of get a feel for it, he would sit right next to this elderly black man who had been on death row for about 20 years. And the guy that he would sit next to, if you put him in a suit and put him on the street, you'd swear he was a professor. So one of the lessons I learned from that was that in 20 years, you're a different person. And so, not to make a push for anything or to get preachy, but, you know, when we execute somebody, we're executing a different person than we convicted. And I think sometimes I remind myself of that too when I want to convict myself for my past, is that I'm sometimes convicting a different person. So anyway, my friend Scott with hate and swastikas and all this, I had given a Dharma talk about, I can't even remember what it was, but about letting go and acceptance, I think was it, and accepting pain and the conflicts of life. He looked at me and said, you know, Roy, I hear what you're saying, but I just can't do it. So you don't understand. I've just got some real problems. And I started to argue with him. I said, well, you know, I understand, but, and then I caught myself and I realized, you know, here's a guy on death row. And a lot of what they were dealing with was, you know, anxiety and not knowing, because any day they could get the word that they were next in line. And I thought back to some of the pain I'd had, some of the troubles I'd had, and, you know, things like divorce, sole custody of my kids, raising three teenage girls, which you can imagine was a bit of a challenge. I mean, there was a lot in my life that I thought, you know, oh, I can compare with any of them. And then I got on death row and I realized, okay, I'm not going to tell him that it's all okay or that he can deal with this. So he looked at me and he said, Roy, you don't understand. And I said, well, okay, I get it. You know, I'm not in your situation. I can't speak for you and I can't tell you what you can or can't do. All I can tell you is what's worked for me. I said, yeah, Roy, you just don't get it. I've got a 13-year-old daughter and she's driving me crazy. And I realized, you know what? Even the guys on death row, they were dealing with the same stuff we were. It was a different context, but their basic feelings are the same as yours and mine. The basic struggles are the same. We're all faced with death. As Tygen politely reminded me, I am going to die. Thanks for that. You know, and we think that if we get something and we get there, we're going to be happy. We're going to have it all. The world will be our oyster. And they did a study of people who had won the lottery. And they studied their happiness levels. And as you can imagine, they got the lottery and all of a sudden, you know, there was, you know, they were going along happy, you know, baseline here. Won the lottery, woo, they're up here. And then they studied people who were quadriplegics, who had been in an accident and lost all control of their body. And they were on this baseline too, and they went down like this. And then they studied them over about 5 years. The lottery winners came back down to baseline, maybe a little above, but right around baseline. And the quadriplegics came up, maybe a little below baseline, but pretty much the same. And there's a term for this, it's called the hedonic treadmill. And it's well studied, is that no matter what good happens to us, we go right back to our baseline. And no matter what bad happens to us, we end up about the same level of happiness. And people living on the street in India is always the example we give. Well, they studied them. The typical person living on the streets in India is about as happy as the person living on the streets in Compton and isn't that much less happy than you or I. Slight differences, but more or less the same. And if you think about it, it makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. If you have a creature that never suffers, it's not going to go out, it's not going to eat, it's not going to hunt, it's not going to get resources. And likewise, so in good times, it's going to find a way to suffer. And in bad times, it's going to find a way to accept that. And I think that the art of Zen is to harness acceptance even when times are good. And to accept suffering no matter what. And to bring curiosity to difficult times. So in difficult times we try and overcome, but if we can bring curiosity and an interest in our own suffering, I think that can help us as well, so that no matter whether it's good, bad, lottery, quadriplegic, we bring the same mindset of curiosity and openness and freedom. So with that, let me just wrap up that, you know, mistakes exist, but only in our own mind. They're our creation, and we can own them, and I've certainly made mine, and even bigger ones than I've talked about tonight. So if anybody has any questions or thoughts.
Jeremy.
So what you said about goals,
mm-hmm.
I actually disagree to a certain extent. And maybe you can reflect and tell me what you think about it. In my job, I have to have a goal I feel like I have to have a goal at least, of a model classroom. I want these standards of my classroom followed, and I have to keep that in mind day by day, because as you might know, or I don't know if you've encountered, but young people can kind of like test your limits constantly,
mm-hmm.
and so you kind of have to have this constant idea of how you want your class to act, so that you can keep those standards day by day and kind of not let, you know, too much go one way or another. I almost feel like in that situation, and probably a lot of others, goals are actually kind of helpful. And maybe it's the attachment to outcome of a goal that's not so good, but an actual having a goal could be very helpful.
Yeah. I guess how I would think about that is that, well, let me give you an example. With my daughters, they were born with a personality. Mm-hmm. And I would like to take credit for for the adults that they are today, and I would like to say it's because of me. It isn't. They were born how they were going to be. Now, I certainly could have screwed them up even more than I did. But what I realized early on, particularly with my middle one, is that I wasn't going to be able to shape her into something that I wanted to be. I could never make her this or that. All I could do would be to help her become her true self as much as I could. And I think that goals in themselves aren't necessarily bad, they aren't necessarily good, but if they become an end in themselves, then we can force people into a particular framework that may not fit. So what I would say is the approach that I would bring is to bring compassion and care to the classroom, to each of those children. Is how can I help them to be their true self, as fulfilling and caring as I can? For some kids and for some classrooms, that may be cracking the whip. For others, that may be total chaos. In 99% of the time, it's probably somewhere in between there. But if we say, okay, here's the goal, here's what it's going to look like, we put ourselves in a limited ability to adapt to what they actually need, what the class may need. Now, that's my thought. Now, that's not to say throw all goals out, you know, but I would say hold them with a loose grasp. So like I didn't have, you know, no goals for my children. I wanted them to be productive. I didn't want them living with me when they're 50. I had certain goals for them, absolutely. But I also realized that, you know, I couldn't make them something other than what they were. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
So. I would also just add that, you know, wanting to maintain some discipline or maintain some standard, maybe a little different than some goal, more traditional type goal, like, you know, I want a nicer car, or I'll be happy if I, you know, get a bigger house, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to, you know, probably maybe in an effort to help them, you're wanting to, you know, be a little strict or maintain some sort of discipline that's going to help them learn or, you know, be productive in that environment.
And one other thing that I should have mentioned too is that, you know, obviously even with my kids, you know, we had to have a goal of getting lunch made every morning. You know, you have certain things you have to teach. So, you know, those are goals. You know, I guess what I would say though is don't let the form overtake the purpose, or, you know, don't make that bigger than the children themselves. The children still have to be the first thing, but that you have, you know, a product that you have to get out there too.
So one goal, I guess, that I have is to end this in time for us to have tea and cookies. I really appreciate that you had a lot of really juicy stuff that we could talk about a long time. But maybe if there's a couple more comments or responses, and then we'll wind it up if anyone has something they want to reflect on from, you know, all of the, you know, really rich material really presented tonight. Any other comments? Don.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the talk. That was really good. So I can appreciate the idea, and I just, of, you know, having to have your life be a certain like way, and like I wonder if everybody gets that idea or has that idea. Like I just because I, you know, I did, and you know I had that even without the whole, you know, fundamental all that stuff. But I had other stuff, you know, but, you know, I had my ideas, and I really appreciate this. It was good to hear that, you know, I guess just to hear it, but I think, and I still get that sometimes, you know, I'll be like, you know, it's just that, boy, if I could just get to a place where I could buy a house, you know, instead of rent, where I feel, you know, and it's, you know, having a certain life, and expecting it to be, and I like that you talked about that, because that reminded me that, you know, it's kind of a constant thing that I find myself doing every once in a while, and not being just, you know, like, this is okay right here. So yeah. I thought that was cool. Thank you.
Yeah, and just to add, I think it's very subtle, and maybe it's particularly in our culture, I don't know, but this, or maybe it's just function of consciousness, but this sense of, or you mentioned the Platonic part of our culture, this sense of some idea of who we should be or how we should do something, or, you know, that really gets in the way of our just enjoying reality. Is there another last comment? Yes,
well,
Nizam.
Just thanks, Roy. I really enjoyed that, and I've always, you know, kind of blown away by when I get an opportunity to actually hear somebody, you know, because I sort of see people how interesting their voice turns out to be, you know. But what I wanted to say was, you know, sort of, you know, God bless the fundamentalists kind of thing, because you know, the. I mean, I really completely endorse everything you're saying about sort of seeing through goals and not, you know, dismissing things by, you know, setting up ideals and striving after them in a certain kind of way. But I also, you know, it seems like every time we talk about something, you know, in a Zen context, there's always a flip side. And, you know, I really respect and also sort of endorse the sort of no that was inherent in that early training you got of, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it in those same terms, but, you know, this sort of appreciation of going, being able to sort of like, you know, this is kind of screwed up, you know, and, you know, which is where that, that, you know, those ideals get generated out of, you know. So how do you, you know, so how do you keep that sort of negativity alive at the same time as you don't get trapped by it? Does that make any sense at all? I mean, it's like...
You're talking about the kind of critical, the countercultural aspect of
the
criticizing
aspect,
conventions
the
reality of our
society. To, like, simultaneously enjoy things as they are, but not sort of sink into this kind of torporous indifference of a lazy kind of acceptance or mm-hmm. something, which I didn't hear in your talk at all, but I didn't hear it, you know, explicitly. I mean, obviously, like this work you're doing in prison, that's like an example of, maybe I just give up. I don't know if I mean, I think there's, you know, I just think there's, I just want to express appreciation for your early upbringing, that's all.
Well, thanks. And I do, let me make clear, you know, I think that, let me put it this way. People within the fundamentalist church are humans. So they're hypocritical, they're liars, they're cheats, they're saints, they're wonderful, they're deep, just like Buddhists. And I think that, you know, for all of us, if we just accept without ever questioning what we're doing, then we can fall asleep on the cushion, we can fall asleep in the pew. Maybe, you know, metaphorically and literally. And so, you know, that's one thing that I really appreciated about them is, you know, there were people there who were, you know, former drug addicts, alcoholics, who really turned their life around and are wonderful, delightful people. And the last thing I would want to do is criticize them or paint them with a broad brush.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, just to back up a little bit. And I wasn't really, you know, I didn't hear that in your talk at all. And not at all. But, you know, the more general thing is just keeping I guess it's about how to stay sort of accepting and give up some of the ideals, but still sort of stay, you know, alert and critical and mm-hmm. Unaccepting of what should be accepted without being, you know, put to sleep by that too. I don't know. I definitely answer. Thanks.